Well, welcome to The Catholic Reason, a radio production of St. Michael Catholic Radio based in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, where we think through various claims made by the Catholic Church concerning issues of faith, morality, and culture, and provide reasons behind those claims. My name is Dr. Carlo Broussard. I'm a staff apologist and speaker for Catholic Answers at Catholic.com and a member of the Chancery Evangelization Team at the Diocese of Tulsa in eastern Oklahoma. The Catholic Reason airs locally here in Tulsa every Thursday from 4 to 5 p.m. on St. Michael Catholic Radio, 94.9 and 102.9. But you may be listening on your own local Catholic radio station at a different time, since The Catholic Reason is now aired on other Catholic stations throughout the country. So, if you're listening outside the Tulsa area, as always, we welcome you, and thanks for joining me. Just to let you know, you can download the show through whichever podcast platform you use by subscribing to the Eastern Oklahoma Catholic Podcast, and you can also access the archived episodes of The Catholic Reason at carlobroussard.com under the audio tab. The title of today's episode is Peter, the Keeper of the Keys. Now, for those of you who are familiar with the Bible, you know the image of the keys, and in particular, the keys of the kingdom of heaven, comes from Matthew chapter 16, verse 19, where Jesus gives Peter the keys of his kingdom. Now, after Jesus reveals that he will make Simon the rock upon which he will build his church, which is an issue of contention with our Protestant brothers and sisters, and that's something that we've talked about before and prior in a prior episode, one of the first episodes that we did for The Catholic Reason, where we gave reasons why we think Simon is indeed the metaphorical rock upon which Christ builds his church. So we have to put that off to a side now, for now. And if you're just joining The Catholic Reason for the first time, or you just started listening, if you go back in the archived episodes, I think it might be like episode 2 or 3 or something like that, to where you can listen to that episode and hear the reasons. I think I gave 7 reasons why we know Simon is the rock upon which Christ promises to build his church. So after Jesus reveals that he makes Simon the rock, Jesus tells Simon in Matthew 16, 19, I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. Now, the Catholic claim is that Jesus is making Peter the first pope. That's to say, Jesus is making Peter the supreme leader of his church here on earth. And the key, pun intended, I know, the key to see why is to understand the significance of the keys of the kingdom. So you might say that this is a second piece of evidence to substantiate or justify the claim that Jesus is making Peter the first pope there in Matthew chapter 16, verses 18 through 19. The first being that Peter is the foundational rock upon which Christ promises to build his church. The keys of the kingdom is a second piece of evidence to establish that Peter is indeed the first pope. So that's what we're going to do in today's episode. We're going to look at the Old Testament backdrop for this imagery of the keys of the kingdom, and then draw out the implications this Old Testament backdrop has for Peter's role in the church. So let's start with the Old Testament backdrop. The image of the keys of the kingdom, so many argue, alludes to an institutional office in the Davidic kingdom known as the royal steward, or master of the palace. When the Israelites structured their kingdom, starting with King Saul and on with David and his sons, etc., they included this type of office within their kingdom. It was called the master of the palace again, or the royal steward. And we get a hint of this office in the prophet Isaiah, particularly Isaiah chapter 22, verses 15 through 22. Within this passage, Isaiah declares an oracle that the wicked master of the palace, one named Shebna, one who is, quote-unquote, over the household, will be deposed or removed from his office of overseer of the household and replaced by a man named Eliakim, son of Hilkiah. Now, the language that Isaiah uses is very telling of the nature of such an institutional office. Again, the one who is over the household, right? Isaiah writes in reference to Shebna, I will thrust, God speaking through Isaiah here, quote, I will thrust you from your office, God tells Shebna, and you will be cast down from your station. In that day, I will call my servant Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, and I will clothe him with your robe and will bind your girdle on him and will commit your authority to his hand. And he shall be a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. And I will place on his shoulder the key of the house of David. He shall open, none shall shut. He shall shut, and none shall open. And I will fasten him like a peg in a sure place, and he will become a throne of honor to his father's house. Now, there are several details here that reveal the nature of this role in the kingdom. The royal steward, the master of the palace. So let's look at these details. The first significant detail is the idea of being over the household. Many scholars affirm that this is an office of the highest authority within the kingdom, of course, apart from the king himself, given that it's delegated authority, right? This role is subordinate to the king. But nevertheless, relative to everyone else, it's of the highest authority. And the first detail, again, is the royal steward being over the house. So here's a bit of commentary from some biblical scholars in order to justify this claim or illuminate the authority that's invested within this office signified by over the house. So scholars by the name of C.F. Kei, K-E-I, or Key or Kai, however you wish to pronounce that, and F. Delitzsch, in their commentary on Isaiah, this is volume 7 of the commentary on the Old Testament on page 398, they write this, the royal steward had the whole of the domestic affairs of the sovereign under his superintendence, and was therefore also called the administrator, as standing nearest to the king. So notice, sovereign under his superintendence, having care of the domestic affairs, nearest to the king. An evangelical scholar by the name of Edward J. Young, in the book of Isaiah, he writes this, a man in such an exalted position would wield an influence of great power even over the king. So that's interesting there. So the royal steward would serve a role as advisor to the king. Now, I'm not going to suggest that Peter is an advisor to Jesus, okay? So just let's nip that in the bud right now. But what this does illustrate is that the royal steward did have a position of authority within the kingdom. Baptist professor John Watts, in his contribution to the Word Biblical Commentary, Isaiah chapters 1 through 33, this is volume 24 of the Word Biblical Commentary on page 292. Watts writes this, Eliakim the steward served as chief of ministers in the royal government. He made decisions which carried royal authority and could not be appealed. That's huge right there. That commentary on the role of the royal steward is key. Again, I'm going to repeat that. Eliakim the steward served as chief of ministers in the royal government. He made decisions which carried royal authority and could not be appealed. That's going to be huge when we begin to apply this to Peter, so keep that in your mind there. Another scholar by the name of Ronald DeVoe in Ancient Israel on page 130, he writes this, like the Egyptian vizier, the master of the palace was the highest official in the state. Now, this comparison to the Egyptian vizier, and that's V-I-Z-I-E-R for those of you who are listening and might be taking notes, you never know. This comparison to the Egyptian vizier is significant because we get a glimpse into this authoritative role in the story of Joseph in Genesis chapter 41, verses 39 through 43. The vizier was a position of authority that was second to none except King Pharaoh himself. It was an office that gave the office holder the authority to govern and rule the kingdom in the king's absence, and consequently demand obedience from the citizens of the kingdom. It was this very position of authority that Jacob's favorite son, Joseph, who was sold into slavery, held and exercised within the Egyptian kingdom after he interpreted Pharaoh's dream. And we get a sense of his authority in Genesis 41, 39 through 43. So here's the text. So Pharaoh said to Joseph, "You shall be over my house, and all my people shall order themselves as you command. Only as regards the throne will I be greater than you." And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Behold, I have set you over all the land of Egypt." There's that idea of over the household, right? Then Pharaoh took his signet ring from his hand and put it on Joseph's hand, and arrayed him in garments of fine linen, and put a gold chain around his neck, and he made him to ride in his second chariot. And they cried before him, "Bow the knee." Thus he set him over the land of Egypt. There you see that overseer role yet again. Now, that Israel has a similar role to that of the vizier, comports with Israel's desire to be a kingdom, quote-unquote, like all the nations in 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 5. And of course, one nation in particular that they would have modeled themselves off of would have been the Egyptian kingdom, given that it was the greatest and most powerful of all the nations. The vizier office was one office within that kingdom that the Israelites adopted. Now, I'm coming up on my first break. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Catholic Reason. More to come on the other side with this role of the royal steward. Well, welcome back, my friends, to The Catholic Reason, a radio production of St. Michael Catholic Radio, based here in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma. My name is Dr. Carlo Broussard, staff apologist and speaker for Catholic Answers, and a member of the Chancery Evangelization Team here at the Diocese of Tulsa in eastern Oklahoma. So in today's episode, we're looking at Peter, the Keeper of the Keys. We're looking at that episode in Matthew chapter 16, verse 19, where Jesus says to Peter, "I give to you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind and loose on earth is bound and loosed in heaven." And in our first segment of today's episode, I was saying how, in order to appreciate what's going on in this exchange between Jesus and Peter and the giving of the keys, we must see it, experience it, against the Old Testament backdrop of this institutional office known as the royal steward, or the master of the palace, in the particular text. So I am arguing in this episode that serves as an interpretive key of Matthew 16, 19, and yes, the pun is intended there, is Isaiah 22, 15 through 22. We read the text already, so I'm not going to read it again. And before our last break, what we were doing is beginning to highlight the details in that passage of Isaiah 22 that illuminate, that reveal the nature of the royal steward office. And that one detail that I was focusing on and zeroing in on was the idea of the royal steward being over the household, and how that signified authority for the royal steward, but not just some authority, but the highest authority over the household, over the kingdom of David, second to none, except the king himself. And I quoted, I don't know, four scholars, Protestant scholars, who affirm this high authority that the royal steward had to exercise within the kingdom. And right at the end of our last segment, I was beginning to compare this royal steward office with the vizier, that is, a position of authority that was second to none except King Pharaoh himself. It was a similar role within the Egyptian kingdom, a role that Joseph, right, in Genesis 41, took over and played out or fulfilled and exercised. And we read about that in Genesis 41, 39 through 43, where we get a sense of that authority that Joseph had in that role as the vizier, second to none except King Pharaoh himself, and Pharaoh makes that explicit in Genesis 41. And I was pointing out how it makes sense that the kingdom of David would have a similar role in the royal steward, because we're told in 1 Samuel 8:5 that the Israelites were desiring to be a kingdom, quote unquote, like all the nations. And the example par excellence, right, of a kingdom that they would have modeled themselves on would have been the Egyptian kingdom. And so it makes sense that the Davidic kingdom would have this role of the royal steward, a position of authority second to none except the king himself, exercising delegated royal authority, overseeing the household of David, that is, the kingdom of David. Okay, so we've only looked at one detail, right? Him having this oversight role, being an overseer over the house of David or the kingdom of David. Now, here's the second detail. The second detail is that it's an institutional office and not a charism. Notice in the text itself, in Isaiah, it says, I will call my servant Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah. I will clothe him. I will bind your girdle and I will commit your authority to his hand. Oh, right there in verse 15, sorry. I will thrust you from your office, God says to Shebna. And of course, he will commit Shebna's authority to the hand of Eliakim. But notice it's an office, right? It's not a personal charism that would just go away with the death of the office holder, of the individual. This being the case, the role of the royal steward, or we could call it the chief royal steward, as John Watts was pointing out in his commentary on the royal steward, the chief royal steward is subject to succession. That is, the office or the role of the chief royal steward is subject to succession and can be occupied by succeeding men. It's not merely a personal charism that dies when the royal steward dies. So that's the second detail to note about this role of the royal steward. It's an institutional office. So you have authority and it's chief authority within the kingdom, and then it's an institutional office, thereby it's permanent and subject to succession by other men. The third detail is we're told that the royal steward is a father to the inhabitants of the kingdom. Protestant scholar Jeffrey W. Grogan, in the Expositor's Bible Commentary on page 144, comments on this. He writes, quote, "The term father suggests both his authority over the people of Jerusalem and also the provision he would make for them in virtue of his office." So that the royal steward is called a father suggests his authority over the people of Jerusalem and being able to provide for them. So that maps on with the label of being over the household of David or the kingdom of David, right? So he's exercising oversight, and insofar as he does that, he is a father to the inhabitants of the kingdom. And then the fourth detail is this idea of opening and shutting. Whatever he shuts, none shall open. Whatever he opens, none shall shut. And so again, this is revelatory of the unique high royal authority that the royal steward possessed in the kingdom. So here's a commentary by Catholic apologist Dave Armstrong in his book, Biblical Proofs for an Infallible Church and Papacy. In chapter 14, he gives some commentary here that I find illuminating. He writes this, "Opening and shutting in Isaiah appear to refer to a jurisdictional power, which no one but the king in the ancient kingdom of Judah could override. Literally, it refers to the prime minister or the royal steward's prerogative to deny or allow entry to the palace and access to the king." So shutting and opening signifies this authority that the chief royal steward had within the kingdom. Now, of course, the last and most important detail for our purposes here is the key of the house of David. So again, Jeffrey Grogan in the Expositor's Bible Commentary writes the following concerning the key of the house of David. Verse 22, he writes, "is not intended figuratively, but literally, for the steward would have the large master key of the palace fastened to the shoulder of his tunic." And then in footnote 15, he writes this, "the official in charge of the royal buildings and supplies would certainly have considerable and probably increasing power." Again, to quote the scholars, Kyle, it's actually Kyle, K-E-I-L, and Delitzsch in their book, Isaiah. They write this: the key was properly handled by the king, Revelation 3:7, and therefore by the house mayor only in his stead. The power of the keys consisted not only in the supervision of the royal chambers, but also in the decision who was and who was not to be received into the king's service. There was a resemblance, therefore, to the giving of the keys of the kingdom of heaven to Peter under the New Testament. And so there, Kyle and Delitzsch are jumping to the New Testament and affirming how the key of the house of David serves as a backdrop or an interpretive context for Jesus giving the keys of the kingdom of heaven. But he's sort of jumping the gun there and stating where we're going here. The Interpreter's Bible, edited by George Buttrick et al., right, we find this statement concerning the key of the house of David. The keys of the kingdom, or the key of the keys of the kingdom, referring to the key of the house of David, would be committed to the chief steward in the royal household, and with them goes plenary authority. So there again, an affirmation of the high authority that the royal steward would have, and which is chief authority, right? No one above the royal steward except the king himself. Again, Baptist professor John Watts, in his Isaiah 1 through 33, writes the following: the steward with the keys also served as the chief of ministers in the royal government. We quoted this already. He made decisions which carried royal authority and could not be appealed. And that is signified by the key of the house of David. Now, there's one more scholarly affirmation that I'd like to share with you, and that comes from Robert Jameson, Andrew Fawcett, and David Brown in their commentary on the whole Bible. They write the following concerning this key of the house of David: the steward is the king's friend or principal officer of the court. Notice, principal officer of the court. The keys are carried sometimes in the east, hanging from the kerchief of the shoulder. But the phrase is rather figurative for sustaining the government on one's shoulders. Notice, the key on the shoulder, literally, was a visible sign or symbol of the government being upon the shoulder of the chief royal steward. Eliakim, continuing with Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, as his name implies, is here plainly a type of the God-man Christ, the son of David, of whom Isaiah uses the same language as the former clause of this verse, and the government will be upon his shoulder. So there, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown are drawing a parallel between Eliakim and Jesus, which, as Catholics, we have no problem with whatsoever, because Old Testament types can be types of on multiple layers, right? So you can have Eliakim be a type of Christ, but as we're going to see here, also be a type of Peter. So now that we have a good grasp of the nature of the role of the royal steward, he's chief among all in the kingdom except the king himself. He exercises a royal authority given to him by the king, overseeing the household of the king, that is, the kingdom of the king. We're told in Isaiah 22, he is over the household, signifying his authority. We are told it's an institutional office, not a personal charism. He's a father. He opens and he shuts, and he possesses a key to signify his authority. Friends, I'm coming up on our second break. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Catholic Reason. Talk to you on the other side. Well, welcome back to The Catholic Reason, my friends. My name is Dr. Carlo Broussard, staff apologist and speaker for Catholic Answers, and a member of the Chancery Evangelization Team at the Diocese of Tulsa in Eastern Oklahoma. Thank you for joining me today for The Catholic Reason, where we're looking at Peter as the keeper of the keys, examining that passage in Matthew 16:19, where Jesus gives Peter the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And we've been, so far in the first two segments, we've just been sort of camping out and slowly walking through Isaiah 22:15-22, which I'm arguing serves as a Old Testament backdrop or an interpretive context for understanding what Jesus is doing in Matthew 16:19 when he gives Peter the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And in Isaiah 22:15-22, we read about this institutional office within the kingdom of David known as the royal steward, the prime minister, or the master of the palace. And it was an oversight role, right? Where the royal steward would exercise oversight over the kingdom of David and had highest authority, second to none, except the king himself, was a final court of appeal. He exercised an authority second to none except the king. And there were a variety of details in Isaiah 22, 15 through 22, that signified that authority. We're told he's over the household. We're told he's a father to the inhabitants of the kingdom. We're told that he opens and shuts and no one shuts or opens, right? Signifying his final authority. And then, of course, the key of the house of David. As commentators have pointed out, a literal key that he would have fastened to his tunic, residing over his shoulder, hanging over his shoulder, which is a visible sign or symbol of the government of the kingdom being upon his shoulders. And so signifying, again, his royal authority and chief royal authority is the highest authority in the kingdom, except the king himself. Now, with this backdrop in mind, now we come to Matthew 16, 19, and we want to make an application to Peter. Our claim here is that Peter is the chief royal steward of Jesus' kingdom. And here's basically the argument in three steps, right? Or you might put it into a modus, what we call a modus ponens argument here. I apologize. It's not a modus ponens. I thought I had it in a modus ponens form, but apparently I don't. So here's premise one. Check it out. Jesus gives Peter the keys of the kingdom. Okay? That's premise one. Premise two. Jesus intends the keys of the kingdom to signify the role of the chief royal steward. And so therefore, Jesus intends Peter to be the royal steward, the chief royal steward of his kingdom. Now, there are a couple of questions here, of course, that arise. Number one, how do we know that Jesus intends the keys of his kingdom to signify the role of the royal steward? That would be a question concerning premise two of the argument, right? And then secondly, even if Peter is the chief royal steward, what are the implications? What sort of conclusions can we draw from that? So let's get into a defense of premise two. We're going to justify Jesus's intention that Isaiah 22:22 is an interpretive context, right? Jesus intends the keys of the kingdom to signify the role of the royal steward. So here's my first reason. The image of a key is used only once in the Old Testament, and that's here in Isaiah 22:22. There's a principle of biblical interpretation. The fewer times an image occurs, especially when it's found prior to its current use, the more likely it is that there's literary dependence. And this supports reading Matthew 16:19 in light of Isaiah 22:22. Far from being a stock image, the metaphor of a key is found in only this place in the Old Testament, Isaiah 22:22. It is found in the New Testament in several places, but it's only found once here in the Old Testament, Isaiah 22:22. And so that provides us good reason to think that this is serving as an Old Testament backdrop for Matthew, who's recording Jesus giving the keys of his kingdom to Peter. Now, a second reason to justify Jesus's intention that Isaiah 22:22 is an interpretive context for what he's doing is that Matthew's the only gospel writer to include this Jewish imagery. We all know that Matthew's gospel is the Jewish gospel, and he often includes images that only would be familiar to the Jewish people, but not the Gentiles. So for example, in Matthew 19:9, St. Matthew's the only gospel writer to record Jesus' clause about divorce and remarriage. If any man puts away his wife, unless it be unlawful, that is porneia in Greek, and marries another, he commits adultery. Why is Matthew the only gospel writer that records this porneia clause? The reason is because it's likely only the Jewish audience would have understood what the porneia clause refers to. When porneia is used elsewhere in Scripture, it refers to unlawful unions, as described in Leviticus 18. So for example, in 1 Corinthians 5, 1-2, St. Paul uses the term porneia in reference to an incestuous relationship, which Leviticus 18 describes as an unlawful union. Furthermore, there's evidence that when this term is used in Acts 15, 20 and 29, it's referring to the same Levitical laws on unlawful unions. And so therefore, Matthew is the only one who records the porneia clause, because only a Jewish audience would understand what it refers to, because it's coming from their tradition. The same applies to the imagery of the keys of the kingdom here in Matthew 16, 19. Matthew's the only one who records this image. Why? Well, seemingly because it comes from the Jewish tradition. But where in the tradition? Well, there's only one plausible candidate here, right? And that's Isaiah 22, 22, because that's the only place where you find the image of a key of the kingdom. Therefore, it's reasonable to conclude that Matthew intends, and of course Jesus as well, intends Isaiah 22, 22 as an interpretive context for the keys of the kingdom in Matthew 16, 19. So that's two reasons so far, right? The image of a key is used only once in the Old Testament, Isaiah 22, 22, and Matthew's the only gospel writer to include this Jewish image, which suggests that it's coming from the Jewish tradition, and the only place it being found is Isaiah 22, 22. Okay, here's a third reason to defend our premise here that Jesus intends the keys of the kingdom to signify the role of the chief royal steward. And that is, the metaphor of the key in Matthew 16, 19 is used in very similar circumstances as that of Isaiah 22, 15 through 22. So consider, for example, the parallel imagery of the kingdom. Isaiah 22, 22 speaks of the house of David, which is just another way of saying the kingdom of David. Well, obviously, Jesus talks about his kingdom, Jesus, son of David, true heir to the throne, speaks of his kingdom in Matthew 16, 19. So you have the kingdom imagery suggesting a parallel, an intentional parallel between these two texts. And then secondly, the parallel theme of having the authority to admit and exclude connects the two passages. That is obvious. This is signified by the binding and loosing language in Matthew 16, 19, and the opening and shutting language in Isaiah 22, 22. He shall open, none shall shut, and he shall shut, and none shall open. All right, so you got binding and loosing, opening and shutting. Both signify jurisdictional of authority, juridical authority, to admit and to exclude. So you have the kingdom imagery, and you have the authority to admit and exclude in both texts, thereby giving us good, strong reason to conclude that Isaiah 22, 22 is an interpretive context for Matthew 16, 19. And then finally, a fourth reason for why we should think that Jesus and Matthew are intending Isaiah 22, 22 to be an interpretive context for Matthew 16, 19 is that even Protestant scholars agree, right? They affirm this interpretation. Check out W.F. Albright and C.S. Mann as they write in their commentary on Matthew, which is part of the Anchor Yale Bible. They write this, Isaiah 22, 15 and following undoubtedly, notice the strong language there, undoubtedly lies behind this saying, referencing Matthew 16, 19, the keys of the kingdom of heaven. The keys are the symbol of authority. And Roland DeVoe in ancient Israel rightly sees here the same authority as that vested in the vizier, the master of the house, the chamberlain, or the royal household in ancient Israel, which is something that we already looked at before. So here we have Albright and Mann affirming that the royal steward office of Isaiah 22 is the Old Testament backdrop in virtue, in light of which we should be interpreting Jesus giving the keys of the kingdom of heaven to Peter, which is akin to, again, the vizier role, that master of the house in the Egyptian kingdom, which Joseph had, according to Genesis chapter 41, a role of very high authority, the highest authority in the kingdom, except the king himself. So given that Isaiah 22, 22 is the only text written before Matthew that has such a degree of similarity to Matthew 16, 19, guys, my friends, we can conclude that Isaiah 22:22 is meant to form part of the conceptual background that Matthew is drawing on and that Jesus is intentionally drawing on. But of course, that just raises the question, what are the implications for Peter? We have solid evidence that the chief royal steward is the backdrop for our interpretation of Matthew 16:19 and what's going on there in the giving of the keys of the kingdom. And so now just the remaining question is, what are the implications for Peter? What can we conclude about Peter's role in the kingdom of Jesus here on earth, which is the church? And that's what we're going to look at on the other side of the break. So we're going to have to hit the pause button here. But again, on the other side, we'll come back and make the connection between Peter and this role of the chief royal steward. Just to give you a hint, Peter's the chief royal steward of Jesus's kingdom. More to come on the other side of the break. God bless, friends. Talk to you on the other side. Well, welcome back, my friends, to the Catholic Reason, to our last and final segment. We were talking about Peter, the keeper of the keys, and we've been going through Isaiah 22, 15 through 22, and providing reasons why we think that passage, which talks about the chief royal steward in the Davidic kingdom, is meant to serve as an interpretive context for the keys of the giving of the keys of the kingdom of heaven to St. Peter by Jesus in Matthew 16:19. The reasons why we think Jesus is intending Isaiah 22:22 and the key of the house of David to be an interpretive context is that the image of a key is used only once in the Old Testament. In this passage, Isaiah 22:22, Matthew's the only gospel writer to include this Jewish imagery, suggesting that it's coming from a Jewish tradition. And since Isaiah 22:22 is the only passage that can serve as a reasonable candidate for that, we can conclude it's an interpretive context for the giving of the keys of the kingdom. And then the metaphor of the key in Matthew 16:19 is used in very similar circumstances as that of Isaiah 22:15 through 22. You have the kingdom imagery, the authority to admit and exclude is in both passages. And then finally, even Protestant scholars agree that Isaiah 22:15 and following serves as an Old Testament backdrop for Matthew 16:19. Now, before our last break, we were asking the question, what are the implications for Peter? Well, here they are. Number one, Peter possesses a specific and distinct office that is permanent and is to be succeeded by other men. That's the first implication, given that Peter is the chief royal steward of Jesus' kingdom, the church. And this just follows from the royal steward office, right? Remember, it was an institutional office succeeded by other men. It was permanent, etc. It was subject to succession. So we can make that conclusion about Peter. Secondly, Peter possesses royal authority delegated to him from King Jesus and is second to none except Jesus himself. And again, this follows from the royal steward having royal authority delegated to him by the king and was chief, second to none except the king himself. Third implication, Peter is a father to the inhabitants of the kingdom of Jesus. Thus, he's a pope, he's a papa. And this follows from the royal steward being a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, or the inhabitants of the kingdom of David. Fourthly, Peter's judgments cannot be overturned. The royal steward office was just that, an office, and the decisions that were made by the royal steward could not be overturned, all right? And we appealed earlier in prior segments, we appealed to Protestant scholars, biblical scholars who affirm that the royal steward was chief and had authority that could not be appealed. It was the highest authority except second to none except the king himself. And given that authority of the chief royal steward, and we know that Jesus is intending to make Peter the chief royal steward, then Peter's judgments are the final court of appeal in Jesus' church here on earth, second to none except King Jesus himself. The last implication would be Peter is immovable in truth, and Christ will not allow his office to fall into error. And this follows from the royal steward office being what we're told in Isaiah 22:23, a peg in a sure place. The role of the royal steward, or the royal steward himself, we're told, is like a peg in a sure place. And of course, given our sacred tradition, which we're appealing to here mostly in order to see that Peter is going to be immovable in truth. So you have a nice convergence here between what we know about Peter and his infallibility and this Old Testament prophecy or Old Testament text about the royal steward being like a peg in a sure place. Okay, so that concludes our answer to the question of what are the implications for Peter in light of Peter being the chief royal steward. And my friends, everything that we just listed that follows from Peter being the chief royal steward maps on to what we believe about the role of the Pope. The Pope is the one who has that chief authority in the kingdom of Jesus, which is the church here on earth, second to none except the king himself, who has supreme authority that cannot be appealed by anybody in the church. And he's immovable in truth. His judgments cannot be overturned. He's a papa, he's a pope, right? He's a father exercising authority over the inhabitants in Jesus' kingdom, the church. Now, there's one more aspect to the keys of the kingdom that's significant for Peter's role as the chief royal steward of Jesus' kingdom. After Jesus promises to give Peter the keys, he tells him, whatever you bind on earth is bound in heaven, whatever you loose on earth is loose in heaven. We've already referenced this in passing in order to show the parallel with the chief royal steward in Isaiah 22:22, where he opens, none shall shut, and he shuts, none shall open. The Catholic claim is that this command to bind and loose signals Peter's unique authority among the other apostles that coincides with his role as the chief royal steward. According to New Testament scholar Kaufman Kohler, according to the scholar Kaufman Kohler in his article, Binding and Loosing for the Jewish Encyclopedia, this language in the Jewish tradition denotes judicial authority, deciding what was forbidden or allowed according to the law. But Kohler points out that rabbis were also said to bind and loose when they would pronounce and revoke an anathema upon a person, thus excluding or restoring a person from or to membership in the faith community. So that's sort of the Jewish context of this language of binding and loosing. That Peter receives the command to bind and loose is not enough, since the same command is given to the other apostles two chapters later, right? What we need here for us to conclude that Peter sort of has this unique role of binding and loosing, what we need for this to match the idea of Peter being the chief royal steward is evidence that this command is unique to Peter. So is it? And there are three reasons to answer yes. Number one, the command is given exclusively to Peter first and then later to the other apostles. Secondly, the uniqueness of this command for Peter is further confirmed by it being given in the context of other unique things said to Peter. He's the rock and he has the keys. So only Peter is told to be the rock of Jesus' church. Only Peter is given the keys of the kingdom. And within that context of unique things being commissioned to Peter, we have Peter being given the command to bind and loose, apart from the other apostles, within the context of these other unique things, thereby suggesting Peter has a unique role in binding and loosing. And then thirdly, we have Protestant affirmation. Lutheran professor Tord Forberg writes this in his contribution to the Southeast Asia Journal of Theology, Volume 4, in his essay or article, Peter, the High Priest of the New Covenant. He writes this: Peter stands out as a kind of chief rabbi who binds and looses in the sense of declaring something to be forbidden or permitted. Peter is looked upon as a counterpart to the high priest. He is the highest representative for the people of God. Notice that emphasis on the chief rabbi, the chief one who is exercising highest authority of forbidding and permitting, right? Counterpart to the high priest. Now, so here's my summary argument. Binding and loosing signifies judicial authority for interpreting God's law and excluding and restoring a person to membership in the faith community. Jesus gives Peter a unique authority to bind and loose, and so therefore Jesus gives Peter a unique authority to interpret God's law and exclude and restore persons to membership in the faith community. Now, a Protestant is going to counter here and say, well, this command to bind and loose simply refers to the ability to preach the gospel and admit people to the kingdom as Peter did with the Jews on Pentecost in Acts 2 and the Gentiles with the household of Cornelius in Acts 10 through 11. Well, in response, notice the text says God will ratify what Peter binds and looses. The subject of action for the binding and loosing on earth is Peter and not God. So Peter has a role to play here. Secondly, the context is church discipline and not preaching to the unevangelized. And that's signified by the binding and loosing, right? We have Jewish scholarship to confirm that binding and loosing signifies judicial authority, which has to do with disciplinary matters primarily with concerning excluding and readmitting people into the faith community. And then thirdly, Peter couldn't bind or withhold the preaching of what God has done. And apologist Jimmy Akin puts this argument best in his Daily Defense on day 349. He writes this, "If one were preaching the gospel, then the other would be withholding the gospel." And this is based upon, again, the objection or the counter from our Protestant friend who might say, all Jesus is telling Peter to do is to go and preach the gospel, and then God's going to be the one binding or loosing, right? So Jimmy says, if one were preaching, if one, that is one of the parts of binding and loosing phraseology, if one were preaching the gospel, then the other would be withholding the gospel, right? Loosing versus binding. And it was not within the purview of the apostles to do that. Peter could not have decided to withhold the gospel from either Jews or Gentiles. And so the interpretation that binding and loosing is exclusively the preaching of the gospel and the focus being on God binding and loosing, that doesn't fit. That interpretation doesn't fit because that would entail Peter withholding the gospel, which is absurd. Well, my friends, that brings us to the end of this week's episode of The Catholic Reason. Our claim is that Peter is the chief royal steward of Jesus' kingdom, thereby making Peter the first pope. We argued for this by way of Jesus giving Peter the keys of his kingdom, which, so we argued, can only be rightly understood within the interpretive context of Isaiah 22, 15 through 22, which describes the office of the chief royal steward. And we also gave some reasons why. As chief royal steward and keeper of the keys, Peter is the supreme binder and looser. The other apostles have such authority, but only in as much as they participate with Peter. So my friends, thanks for listening to The Catholic Reason, a production of St. Michael Catholic Radio based in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma. You can download the show through whichever podcast platform you use by subscribing to the Eastern Oklahoma Catholic Podcast. And you can also access the archived episodes of The Catholic Reason at CarloBrusor.com under the audio tab. I invite you to join me again next week for The Catholic Reason as we continue looking at Catholic claims and the reasons behind them. Tell a friend. I'll talk to you then. God bless.